Okay, is that working? Can you hear me in the back?
Yes.
More?
Yeah.
More? I don't know. I can't give you any more. I don't even know why I'm asking. can't hear? Okay, and I got to turn this one on too. These things make me really uncomfortable because I had a very near accident with one a couple years ago. I mean, as some of you saw, I just can't figure out how the hell to turn the thing on. There we go. As some of you saw, you know, I did the sort of, we turned it on and did a sound test a while ago, and we didn't do a sound test on this one. Anyway, so I did them, and then I was wandering around, and those of you I hope didn't see that I went to the bathroom in between. And a couple years ago, I was at Twin Falls, Idaho, and we did the sound test, and then, I don't need to finish the story. We'll just pass over what happened next. Strange looks when I came back, you know. So seriously, can you hear me in the back? Okay, I don't know if this means groovy or if this means more. Okay, great. So thank you so much for coming. I'm really glad you're here. I'm really glad I'm here too. And I would like to thank some people in specific before we start. Cease Weiss, Ian and Marion. And I think we should actually stop after Ian and Marion and we'll go a little further. Ian, Marion, Donna, Angie, and Lana. And I think we should stop right there and give them a round of applause for the wonderful Okay, and then we're gonna do that again in a second. Bobby, Leslie, and Daniel. Is Daniel still in here? And Daniel is the reason that all of you are here. And then there's also Joseph Roberts. Where's Joseph? Where'd he go? Thank you so much. Zoe, Paul, Abigail, Peter. Oh yeah, Peter for the sound. Without Peter, I'd be sitting here quietly. Frank, and the Burnaby Teachers Association Social Justice Committee, the BC Teachers for Peace and Global Justice, SF PERG, East End Food Co-op, Seven Oaks, Paloma Housing Co-op, Banyan Bookstore, People's Cooperative Bookstore, Thomas Hicks, Necessary Voices, for recording the show. And is Thomas here? So is it recording? How are you recording? I don't have anything attached to me.
I have a line out for the mixer.
Oh, that's great. Okay. I mean, this just shows what they tell me. So, I don't know if you know this, but the original draft of the movie Star Wars was not written by Lucas and Company. The original draft was written by environmentalists, and I happen to have a rare first draft of that screenplay on my person. And is there anybody in here who does not know the plot of the movie Star Wars? Holy crap. That's a lot. You know, usually when I ask this question, it's like one person raises their hand. I think that's really cool, actually. That's like 30 people raise their hands. So for those of you who don't know the plot, here's the plot of Star Wars in a nutshell. And the movie came out in 1977, and I saw it when I was in high school, which is the perfect time to see that movie. Because I went to see it and I told all my friends, oh man, the acting is so good. And I thought it was a great movie. I wasn't one of those nerds who saw it, you know, 1,000 times or anything. Well, for one thing, I'm not a nerd, and for another thing, I was way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. But anyway, the basic plot is that the Empire has constructed this giant machine that is capable of destroying entire planets called the Death Star. and it's capable of destroying entire planets. And that's a wonderful metaphor for the dominant culture, of course. It's a machine that's destroying planets, or a planet in this case. And so what happens in the movie is that the rebels figure out a way to blow up the Death Star. And so then Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters and then to drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port. I guess maybe I'm kind of a nerd. Anyway, so he finds a way to get past all the TIE fighters and drop a torpedo down the thermal exhaust port and blow up the whole Death Star. And that's pretty much, I ruined the movie for you. But you should still watch it for the acting. And anyway, so the movie that the way that the environmentalists wrote it was actually a bit different. For one thing, they didn't call it Star Wars. They called it instead Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. And another difference is that in this version, they didn't actually blow up the Death Star. Instead, the way that they wanted to stop the Empire was they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover that there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors. And they will leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. Scribbled in the margin is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it's imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, that they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Other plans include sending petitions and filing lawsuits. Now, we all know that all of that would be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers to stand on the planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. And stirring debates are held on screen among these rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. But there's more. Once inside the Death Star, a splinter group breaks off from those about to lock themselves down. And they rush down these long hallways, and they somehow avoid all the troopers, and they burn a couple transporters, and they use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And then there's another group that breaks off from them, and they sneak down more hallways, they get past more troopers, and finally they make it all the way to Darth Vader's private room. And he's there by himself. They sneak up behind him, and then they hit him with a vegan cream pie. The producers decided to cut that scene, though, because it was far too close to something that was happening in another movie they were developing at the same time, which was called The Plot to Pie Hitler. Near the end of the movie, there's another debate that's held among the rebels, and that was actually a problem I had with the environmentalist screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must, above all else, have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he, too, was once a child. One writer put in the margins, "Excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere." And he didn't mention whether those tears would be of frustration. Finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up and tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the Rebels, of course, are just horrified. In the exciting final scene of the environmentalist version, a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, and Chewbacca on one side and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase those four from the room and from the film, which is not a big deal because they're minor characters anyway. Anyway, so then what happens, the way the movie ends, is that the Death Star looms closer and closer, and audience members just chew their fingernails as they wait to see whether the letters and petitions and lawsuits work their magic. Viewers see lasers inside the Death Star warm up to destroy the planet. So you see the planet, and then you see the Death Star, and you see the planet, and the Death Star, you see the lasers glow this hellish red, and then you see the planet again, and then you see, there's this little streak of light. And what that is that's the environmentalists getting away before the planet's blown up. And then of course, you see the planet get blown up. And then the very final shot of the movie, which shows what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times that devotes a full 3 sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press. That's the end of the story. I was in Asheville, North Carolina a few years ago, and I was giving a talk, and afterwards during the Q&A, this one guy said, "So how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb?" And I said, "I don't know. I'll bite. How many?" And he looked at me and he said, "It wasn't a riddle." And I'm like, that's not how this is supposed to work. And then that night, I went back to my hotel, and I really obsessed about that question, which frankly says a lot more about my social life than I want it to. And I finally came up with an answer, which is, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 10. 1 to write the light bulb or letter requesting that it change, 4 to circulate online petitions, 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change, 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way real change occurs, 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself, 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change, and finally, 1 to smash the fucking light bulb, because we all know it's never going to change. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize? So large that horses were afraid to get in the water, so large you couldn't see the bottom of the river. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons that were so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, horizon to horizon, flying 60 miles an hour and sounding like rolling thunder. There were 6 times as many passenger pigeons as all other birds in North America combined. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews that are almost as large. Maybe it'll take the death of the great ox. Does anybody in here know why there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? There were. They were called great auks, A-U-K-S. And there were so many all over the North Atlantic that even on one island, a French explorer said that they could fill every ship in France and it wouldn't make a dent. And they did, and it did. And the last great auk was killed in the 19th century. So maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take global warming before you finally call it an apocalypse. Maybe it'll take dioxin in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take flame retardant in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take the hole in the ozone. You know, give me a specific threshold, Derek, a specific point at which you finally use that word." I think a lot about why we're losing so badly. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I think one of the reasons is that I'm not sure that a lot of us as environmentalists or as human beings are really clear on what we want. You know, do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, gentler clear cuts? Do we want the Canucks to win the Stanley Cup and it'd be nice if we still have a world? You know, what do we want? I'm really clear on what I want. I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. I want to live in a world with wild polar bears. I want to live in a world with wild apes. I want to live in a world where there isn't dioxin in every mother's breast milk. And I'll do whatever it takes to get there. I think there's another reason that we lose so often, and that's there's this great book written by Robert J. Lifton called The Nazi Doctors. And in that book, he asked the question, how was it that these people who had taken a Hippocratic oath could go and work in a death camp, and in the Nazi death camps or concentration camps? And what he found is that most of the doctors who worked there actually cared about the inmates, and they did everything within their power to help the inmates. They would give them, if they got sick, they would give them an aspirin to lick, or they would hide them from the selection officers who were taking them to be gassed, or they would put them to bed for a day or two. They would do everything they could to help the inmates, except for the most important thing of all, which is they wouldn't question the existence of the death camp itself. They wouldn't question working them to death. They wouldn't question gassing them to death. They wouldn't question starving them to death. They wouldn't question the mindset that led to it in the first place. And I think that I see that a lot. I see so many environmentalists, and I include myself, absolutely include myself, that, you know, we're doing everything we can to save this or that scrap of ground, and that's desperately important work. But what I don't see us doing so often is questioning the larger death camp culture. And that's not good enough for me. It's not good enough for me that lynx and bobcat and grizzly bears and salmon live out a few more generations before they're ultimately exterminated. That's not good enough. A question I ask all over the continent is, do you believe that the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever says yes. Most people laugh. It's a stupid question. At one of my talks, this one guy raised his hand. Everybody looks at him. He goes, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the point is that we will someday be living sustainably, or we won't be living at all. But whether that transition will be voluntary, I don't think so. And the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And that's something I'll do a little bit later in the talk, is bash hope. It's one of my favorite things to do. So Endgame, the new book, is really about, and this talk is really about, that shift in strategy and tactics. And it's about getting to that shift. And one of the things I do in that book is I lay my premises out explicitly, as many as I can, before the book starts. And, excuse me, one reason that I do that is because one of the first rules of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. And so a great example of that, it was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So Hitler could ask, what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? And you can go, gosh, Adolf, that's a good question. But what he's done is he's slid the premise by you that there's a Jewish problem you got to do something about. And likewise, we can hear some talking heads say, so, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Good question. Well, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? And I don't want to do that. I want to be as explicit as I can about my premises. And so that's what I'd like to do for most of the rest of the evening, is to go through some of these premises. And the first premise is that industrial civilization entirely, but especially industrial civilization, is not and can never be sustainable. Industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. A few years ago, I was riding in a car with my friend George Drafin, And I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George is a very nice guy, but sometimes he is kind of a curmudgeon. And that day he was not in a very good mood, and he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question really is what's left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, I would say it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And, I mean, if you have a finite amount of some resource and you're using it up, eventually you're going to run out. And so you would think that if you have an economy that's based on, I don't know, let's take a random example. Oil. That you would consider what's going to happen when this oil runs out. And I'm going to take it a step further, and I'm going to say that any way of living that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. If every year there are fewer salmon return than the year before, eventually you'll run out. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons run out, or every year there are fewer passenger pigeons return than the year before, eventually you'll run out. And, you know, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. I mean, think about this in terms of like finding a sexual partner. I mean, imagine if you're a woman, say, look around and just imagine if 90% of the guys over 5 feet tall are gone. So basically what that means is you get a bunch of 12-year-olds that you have for possible partners. I really don't want to take that any further. So any way of living that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. I know that we're always told that, you know, natural selection, evolution is based on survival of the fittest. You know, it's basically those who can exploit resources the best are the ones who survive. And this shows the stupidity of our culture. I can disprove the idea that nature, that survival, that evolution is based on that sort of competition. I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me two semicolons. And that's those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. Dolores LaChapelle just died, and she taught me that when you think about natural selection, instead of thinking of survival of the fittest, think of survival of the fit. It's how well you fit into your surroundings. That's what really determines whether you survive in the long run. Okay, I'm going to take this a step further and say that any way of life that's based on the use of resources won't last. And the reason I say that is because resources don't exist. Salmon don't consider themselves a fisheries resource, and trees don't consider themselves a timber resource. They're just salmon, they're just trees. And this is really important because R.D. Lang wrote this great book called The Politics of Experience, and it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and you should read it for yourself, but I'm going to give you a Cliff Notes version, which is that the way you experience the world influences how you behave, and the way you perceive the world influences how you behave. And a great example of that, there's a line by a Canadian lumberman, "When I look at trees, I see dollar bills." And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you're going to treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'm going to treat it differently still. Same with salmon. If when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'm going to treat them another way. If when I look at this particular salmon, I see this particular salmon, I'm going to treat her a different way still. It's the same with women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'm going to treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'm going to treat her differently still. That's absolutely crucial. And the fact that I perceive a salmon as a salmon doesn't mean that I can't eat that fish. I was doing an interview, a radio interview, in Spokane, Washington a few years ago, and the interviewer said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And I knew that answer was pretty much bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. And so anyway, that afternoon, I went out, and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of that other's community. If you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of that other's community. So if I consume the flesh of Klamath River salmon, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. I got in a big argument a few years ago with this guy because he said that because I use toilet paper, I'm just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. I knew that answer wasn't quite right, but I couldn't really respond to him, and I just except to say no. And oh, I have to tell you this, you know, those of you who've read my books, I'm not really as smart as I seem, because one of the great things about being a writer is that I get to win every argument. Because like in the books where I have a conversation where my friend says something really smart, and then I say something really smart back, and then they say something really smart, and I say, that's not how it happened. How it really happened is they said something really smart, and I said, yeah, that makes sense to me. And then I go back, and then I call them up like 6 weeks later, and I've got this smart response. And then they immediately say back to me the next thing, and it's like, I'll get back to you. Well, and I have a great example of that from a couple weeks ago. I did this radio interview in Santa Barbara, and it was so horrible. It was this right-wing, anti-environmentalist, property rights, uber alles, Bible thumper. And he basically just wanted an environmentalist to yell at. And it was so interesting because he kept saying, you know, I was talking about, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone on dioxin and every mother's breast milk. He kept saying the same thing, which is, Derek, get back in the real world. And that's his real world. I mean, think about this. Those of you who are either in college or have been to college, I mean, all the time people are saying, what are you going to do when you get in the real world? And what they mean, of course, is what are you going to do when you get to industrial capitalism? You know, it's like, what am I going to do when I get in the real world? I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? Anyway, so he ended the interview. Right near the end of the interview, he said, you know, it's very clear that, you know, he said in Genesis, it says that God gave man dominion over the earth. And it's very clear that you don't have an appreciation for that. And my answer was pretty tepid. I basically said something about how if you attempt to express dominion over something, then you're going to not be able to enter into a relationship with it, and you're probably going to kill it. And it's an okay answer, but wasn't that great. And like 4 hours later, I came up with the answer I should have given to him. And the answer I wish I would have said is, when he said, you know, it's clear you don't have an appreciation for God giving man dominion over the earth, I wish I would have said, no, actually, I do. I have great appreciation for that. And in fact, just last night, I was talking to God, and God said, you know, when I said before that God gave man dominion over the earth, I wasn't specific enough. What I really meant is God gave Derek dominion over the earth. And God especially gave Derek dominion over radio interviewers from Santa Barbara. And so what this means is that everything of yours, Andy, actually belongs to me. And if you don't like it, me and my fellow religionists are going to come down and take it because God said we could. And if he said that that's not in the Bible, I would say, I can't help it if you read the wrong Bible. Where were we? Now you see why my books are written in a nonlinear fashion, by the way. Oh, so the guy said that because I use toilet paper, I'm just as culpable for deforestation. So I didn't have an answer. And he said, well, go ask a tree. And I did. I went out and asked a tree. And the tree said, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. And then the tree said, yes, you are actually culpable, but not because you consume the flesh of a tree. You're culpable because you consume the flesh of a tree and you don't stop Weyerhaeuser. That's why you're culpable, because you don't fulfill your end of the bargain. If you consume the flesh of a tree, you now take responsibility. Once again, the problem is not me consuming the flesh of a tree. The problem is me consuming the flesh of a tree and not taking responsibility for the continuation of the forest community. Okay, that's all nice, Derek, but what the hell does that have to do with civilization? And okay, so I've been bashing civilization for about 15 years now, and I finally decided with this new book I better define it. And civilization I've defined as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. Cities really are the beginning of civilization. And once again, that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And that's really important because two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. Well, first off, what this means is that the Talawa, on whose land I now live, the Talawa Indians, they were not civilized. They did not live in cities. They lived in villages, camps. They didn't require the importation of resources. They didn't require importing anything to eat. They ate salmon, elk, clams, smelt, huckleberries, salmon. And then through the winter, they would eat a lot of salmon. And they lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talawa, then they lived there since the beginning of time. One more little digression, if you don't mind, is I was at Princeton University last spring, and I said the thing about the Talawa living there for 12,500 years, and this one guy in the audience interrupted me to say, well, the fact that they lived there for 12,500 years doesn't mean they were living sustainably. And I said, okay, what would be a measure? And he said, well, the only way you could tell is if you did, I'm not making this up, the only way you could tell is if you did quantitative analysis to show that there were the same number of salmon 12,500 years ago as there are now. And I said, you're a science major, aren't you? It's like, how did you know? Two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, I know resource is a bad word, but we're going to go ahead and use it. If you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you will denude an ever larger area if you require it. The other thing that means is that your way of living must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, and the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for them, you're going to take them because you require them. Which means that we could all become junior bodhisattvas and the U.S. military would still have to be huge because otherwise how are they going to get access to the oil that they need to run their economy? Okay, so that's premise one. And that takes up this much. So you did bring sleeping bags, right? Premise two. Traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. That's something we've seen once or twice on this continent. The third premise. This way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. This way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. I was doing a talk in Eugene, Oregon a few years ago, and afterwards this one guy, and it's significant he was a guy, said, you know, I'm very nonviolent. I don't see any violence in my life. You talk about this culture being violent. I don't see it. I see none of it. And the reason it's significant that it's a guy is, you know, very few women could say that, you know, given that 25% of all women in this culture are raped in their lifetime, and the 19% fend off rape attempts. And all the women I know say those figures are very low, and that the actual figures for sexual abuse of women, much higher. Never mind the fact that within this, I think it's in the United States, that one woman is beaten by her lover every, I think it's 8 seconds, or maybe 18 seconds. So it's like, it's much easier for a man to say he doesn't see any violence in a woman. But in any case, he said he didn't see any violence. So first thing I said is, so where's your shirt made? And he looked and he said, it's made in Bangladesh. And I said, so do we need to talk about this? And he said, no, I think I get that. And I said, okay, well, I got something else, another question for you, which is, do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. I said, why? And he said, because I don't own? And I said, no, what would happen if you didn't pay rent? He said, well, I get evicted. I said, I don't know what that means. Tell me what would happen. He said, well, the sheriff would come to my house. I said, stop right there. Okay, so the sheriff comes to your house, and it's just about dinner time, so you invite him in. And you say, hey, I was just finishing dinner. You want some? And he comes in, and he eats dinner with you. And then afterwards, you say, you know, your company has been kind of pleasant, but not really all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave my home now. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would pull out his gun, and he'd say, you didn't pay your rent, so I'm here to evict you. I said, ah. So the reason you pay your rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and kick you out of your home. He's like, I don't get it. I said, okay, let's try again. You're really hungry. You go to the grocery store. You start eating. There's a lot of food there, you know? And what's going to happen? He said, well, they're going to call their sheriff and he's going to come get me. I said, yeah, that guy's a real asshole, isn't he? And so I said, okay, so what this means is that in order to sleep, in order to survive on this planet, you have to pay someone. And in order to eat, in order to survive, you have to pay someone. And if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and do something bad to you. So maybe part of the reason that so many of us don't see this violence in our lives is because we're so fully metabolized into the system that we don't fight it. And if you don't fight it, then maybe the guns don't get pointed at you. And then I want to tie this to one more thing, which is that I was doing a talk in Massachusetts a few years ago, and this one guy afterwards said, you know, we're living way more sustainably now than we were 100 years ago. And I said, how could you possibly say that? He said, well, look around. We were inside, so it didn't count. But he said, after when you go outside, look around, because there's a lot more trees in Massachusetts now than there were 100 years ago. I said, yeah, it's because you get your wood from South America. I mean, so you're simply exporting the violence. So that's another reason that so many of us don't see this violence, is because it's simply exported. Fourth premise. Oh, this is one of my favorite ones. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there are so many examples of this. My father is extremely violent. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time. Why? Because he'd committed blasphemy. He'd sent violence up the hierarchy. That's one example. Another example is cops. Every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 people die because they encounter police. And on the other hand, every time a cop dies, there's this big state funeral, you know, the bumper sticker, some gave all gave some. You know what the most dangerous civil service profession is? Garbage collection. Way, way more dangerous. But when was the last time you saw a state funeral for a garbage collector, you know, with a big bumper sticker, so, you know, some gave all gave some? You know, when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where this intrepid garbage man is cleaning up the mean streets of L.A., you know? It's not going to happen because it's not valorizing that violence. What's another example? Bears. Where I live, there's bazillions of bears. And, you know, I walk through the forest all the time at night, don't ever have a flashlight or anything. And everybody's like, oh, my God, aren't you afraid of the bears? I mean, they're going to kill you. And I respect the bears, but I know that there's one person dies in North America every other year because of a bear attack. And on the other hand, there's 46,000 people die in the United States every year because of automobile accidents. So the truth is, we should be, you know, walking happily through forests, but then you go through a parking lot and it's like, oh my God, you know, and the cars are like, we're gonna get you. I mean, why do you think the garbage collectors have this high rate of mortality? All those big fucking trucks are like, now we got him. What's another example? Oh, you know, damn it. It's like that, I live 3 miles from the ocean. You know how often I get in the water? Never. You know why? Because of that fucking movie Jaws. You know? I saw that thing when I was like 15. And I get within 100 yards of the water, I hear that goddamn theme music. And what? I'm not quite that bad. That's kind of scary. You see sharks in the swimming pools? Okay. I will thank you for adding that to my list of neuroses. From now on at talks, I'll be saying I don't get in the ocean, I don't get in swimming pools, I don't even get in the fucking shower, you know? Anyway, but the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally 20 million to one. What's another example? 9/11. You know, when was the last time you heard a politician in the United States, especially, give a speech where they didn't mention 9/11, 9/10, frankly, and there were 3,000 people died in that attack, but there are, and it's, you know, totally fetishized, but at the same time, there are 15,000 people in the United States die every 2 weeks because of preventable cancers. And there are 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from the so-called third world to the so-called first world. But of course that's invisible. That doesn't count. Or there are 6,000 people in the United States die every year as a direct, because of unsafe work. No, it's 60,000. 600,000. 6 million. Every person in the United States dies every year. No, it's 600,000. 60,000. In any case, it's more. But that doesn't count because it's not violence going up the hierarchy. One more example. I love this example. Does anybody mind if I swear? Too late. Oh, that's the difference between the talk I'm doing tonight and the talk tomorrow night, is they have prohibited swearing tomorrow night, so which is going to cut about 20 minutes from the talk. So any of you who are going tomorrow night, you'll just have to carry the swear words with you. Hey, could I bring a plant? And so I go, you know, it's that, and then somebody in the audience can go, fucking theme music from Jaws. I won't be doing it. Okay, anyway, so what I want to do now that has to do also with this violence flowing down thing is an exegesis of the word fuck. Because fuck, I think, is the most amazing word in the English language, because it's all of patriarchy condensed into four letters. It's really, really, really disturbing that the same word that means make love to means do great violence to. That once again, that's all of patriarchy, and that's so disturbing. It's really messed up. And it's also, frankly, really confusing, because, I mean, somebody can say to me, I'm going to fuck you. And I'm like... I need more information. And the way this ties to the whole violence flowing down the hierarchy thing has to do partly with homophobia, and then also, I mean, this helped me finally understand homophobia. Okay, there's this line by Catherine McKinnon I just love. It's man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. And, I mean, it shows how deep the objectification of women goes in this culture, that within a context of loving heterosexual relationship, it's really difficult to not objectify the woman. And so the man can say to the woman, I would like to be inside of you. You know what just happened? She's the object of the sentence. So the woman says to the man, I would like for you to be inside of me. She's still the object of the sentence. So then the man is going to try to be really feminist. He says, I would like for you to be around me. And she's like, I don't know, can you speak English? I don't know what you want. So it gets really interesting because when you conflate sex and violence, which I'm not saying they should be conflated, I'm saying patriarchy does that. When you conflate sex and violence can only flow down, that's what finally helped me understand homophobia. Because I'd never understood homophobia before. Because it always seemed pretty clear to me that if you don't like homosexuals, you probably just shouldn't date one. But I finally got it, and this is back in the whole Clinton don't ask, don't tell thing, you know, where homosexuals can be in the U.S. military, but they can't talk about it, and you know all about that. Which I have to say, as just full disclosure here, that I actually agree that homosexuals should not be allowed into the U.S. military. But that probably means less than it could otherwise, because I also don't think that heterosexuals, asexuals, the transgender, and bisexuals should be allowed in the military either. Except, actually, I was thinking, what if they each had their own army? Wouldn't that be fun? It's like the bisexual brigade to the rescue, you know? Anyway, so there was this spokesman. It was a man. The spokesman, this is years ago. This is when I finally understood homophobia. The spokesman said, he was talking about why homosexuals should not be allowed in the military. And he said can you imagine what would happen if a private has sex with a lieutenant? And I was thinking, yeah, I can imagine that, but that wasn't really his point. And he was saying that it would destroy chain of command. And not because the lieutenant would fall in love with the private and not be able to order the private to his death, but instead, notice that he said, what would happen if a private had sex with a lieutenant? He did not say, what would happen if a lieutenant had sex with a private? The reason that would destroy chain of command is because when you conflate sex and violence, and when violence can only flow down, then what that means is you have to have a fucker and a fuckee. And the fuckee has to be lower on the hierarchy than the fucker. And so when you get, like, homosexuals, then you have a fucker and a fuckee at the same level, and all the little tiny brains just seize up. Because it's blasphemy. It's, you know, actually, I think I've sort of beaten this idea to death. Okay, so if I am beating an idea to death, is that violence? Okay. Exactly. Fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. I love that one. Okay, sixth premise. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, this culture will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. And by the way, I want to be really clear. Every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. I'm not saying I don't want that. What I'm saying is that I don't think it's going to happen. And another thing, I want to be really clear that when I talk about resistance and I talk about fighting back, because I will more and more as we go through the talk, I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy. I don't believe in that at all. I think we need it all. Because if we all wait for the great, glorious revolution, there's not going to be anything left anyway. And at the same time, if all we do is reform work, this culture is going to continue to grind away until there's nothing left. And the moment, actually, when I realized the reform versus revolution question is bullshit, is I used to teach at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a super maximum prison in Northern California. And I know that the U.S. prison system is the biggest racist gulag on the planet. And I was walking in there, you know, working in that system. And at the same time, a lot of my students were telling me that the only things that were keeping them sane were my classes. And so at that moment, the revolution and reform question fell apart. Because once again, we need it all. And we'll talk about that more later. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it, and for those who come after. If somebody were brought down civilization 200 years ago, if Tecumseh would have won, then people in the Northeast could still eat passenger pigeons. If somebody were brought it down 100 years ago, people in the Northwest would not have to worry about salmon going extinct. The Klamath would still be full of salmon. We wouldn't have to worry about docks in every mother's breast milk. We wouldn't have to worry about global warming. We wouldn't have to worry about all these other things. I mean, 50 years from now, are people going to be going, God, you know, if people would have brought it down 50 years ago, we'd still have amphibians. You know, we'd still have great apes. We'd still have polar bears. I mean, what is it going to take? You know, at what point? You know, how bad does it have to get? Eighth premise. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I have just guaranteed I will never hold public office. You know, another way to put this one is that the only measure by which we will be judged by the people who come after is the health of the land base. They're not going to give a shit as to whether we were nice or not nice. They're not going to give a shit as to how hard we tried. They're not going to give a shit about whether we recycled. They're not going to give a shit about whether we tried really, really hard. They're not going to give a shit about how good we were at the, you know, how great books we wrote. They're not going to care. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. What they're going to care about is whether the land can support them. They're going to care. I mean, it's embarrassing to have to say that the land is everything. You know, we can fantasize whatever we want about some eco-socialist utopia with free love, And if you can't breathe the air, it doesn't fucking matter. Or tomorrow night's version will be, it doesn't matter. You know, I have a new slogan, which is, protect your land base. You can't have sex without it. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic... You know, that's one of the things that bugs me, by the way, about all those solutions that are, in quotes, that are proposed to global warming and all that. Did you notice what they always take as the given? They always take industrial civilization as a given. That it's basically, how can we keep the economy going? And if we have a planet, that'll be nice. And that's insane. That's an inverse of reality. That, once again, without a land base, you don't have an economic system. You don't have anything. Anyway, another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. Okay, the ninth premise... the ninth premise... I've noticed that I can bash almost anything I want. You know, I can bash capitalism, nobody cares, bash corporations, nobody cares, bash Christianity, nobody cares, bash environmentalists, nobody cares, bash anarchism, nobody cares. Oh, and a lot of people consider me an anarchist, and maybe I am an anarchist, probably. Oh, by the way, two things. I'm going to tell you a couple of anarchist jokes. One of them is I can tell you why there's not going to be an anarchist revolution, because I was down in Florida maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and after my gig, maybe 7 or 8 of us anarchists were going to go out to dinner. And it took us about 45 minutes to come to consensus on who gets in which car. And we never did come to consensus. Finally, this one woman just said, look, you three this car, you two this car, you two this car. And we're like, cool. Which maybe that's how the revolution has to come, is she has to call it. Okay, we'll skip my other anarchist joke for now. But the point is I can bash all these things and nobody cares. But there are a few things that I can't really bash without people freaking out. It's like if I start to bash science, I can just feel the sphincters in the audience start to quiver. And another one that's really, you can't bash is you can't bash Buddhism. I mean, if I bash, you know, you have not lived. You have not lived until you've been chased down the street by a bunch of angry pacifists. And another one that you can't talk about is you can't talk about population. Because if you talk about the fact that there's more people on the planet than the planet can support, then everybody presumes that you must hate children. I actually don't really like kids. But that's neither here nor there. Monster! Monster! Okay. So the ninth premise is... Well, before we get to the ninth premise, I'm just going to say that there are more people on the planet than the planet can support. Humans have exceeded carrying capacity. Carrying capacity is the number of any given species who can live in any particular place forever without damaging the land base. So you could have an island that has a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer. And you could have 1,000 deer live there forever. But if you have 10,000 deer on the island, they're going to eat too much of the vegetation, they're going to denude the landscape, erosion, blah, 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 and they're going to permanently reduce the carrying capacity. Oh, by the way, everybody says there's no such thing as a stupid question. I got one the other day, and I'm going to share it with you. Whenever there's this radio station one county south of me where whenever I'm on there, it's K-Mud, by the way, whenever they have me on there, there's this one guy who hates my work so much that he has to call up, and I think he attacks me, but I never can figure out what the hell he's saying. And this one time I said, you know, humans have exceeded carrying capacity. And he called up sputtering and said, how dare you say that humans have exceeded their capacity to care? Which may be the case, but it's a different question. Humans have exceeded carrying capacity, but I have to say that I don't think the population overpopulation is a primary problem. I think overpopulation is actually a tertiary problem. And the reason I think it's a tertiary problem, well, first off, it's a secondary problem instead of primary, because Actual numbers don't mean anything. You could have 100 gazillion people on the planet, and if they didn't eat, shit, or stand anywhere, it wouldn't matter. The important thing is how much damage they cause. And so if you have, I mean, who causes more damage? I mean, okay, who causes more damage? You know, some poor child in a third world nation. I mean, the first thing, when I think of overpopulation, the first thing I think of is some poor child in a third world nation with a distended belly from malnutrition. But when I think of overconsumption, the first thing I think of is a fucking Canadian, actually. You know, I was going to say somebody from the United States, but you know what I heard? I heard that you Canadians use more resources per capita than even people in the United States. That's a nice excuse, buddy. I don't buy it. It's your fucking fault. We in the United States got nothing to do with it. So I think overconsumption is actually more important than overpopulation. That's not to say there aren't more people on the planet can support, but once again, overconsumption is a bigger problem. But the reason I think it's not actually secondary, but tertiary, is that, are there any demographers in here? Are there any demographers in here? Good, I hate demographers. And the reason I hate them is because, sometimes they talk about something called a natural rate of population increase, and they presume that humans breed like rabbits. But the truth is, I don't even think rabbits breed like rabbits. They presume that people don't make rational family planning decisions based on their personal and social circumstances. But for crying out loud, worms. If worms have a limited food supply, they limit the number of babies they have. And they don't even have a brain. They do have 5 hearts, though, so maybe that's it. The reason this is important is because our personal social circumstances include the culture in which we're based. And if you have a culture that's planning on living in the same place for the next 500 years, for the next 1,000 years, and you have a culture that has an intimate relationship with that land, you might limit the number of babies you have. You might live in a steady state. You might not make a fetish out of growth. And on the other hand, if somebody writes in a book that you should go forth and multiply, and if this book becomes a really big bestseller, then you're going to make different family planning decisions. Another way to talk about this is that in North America, the Native North Americans used, I believe it was about 250 different plants as contraceptives and abortifacients. And it was the women who made the decision to use them. That's a bunch of fucking primitives. I don't know what their problem is. And I gotta tell you the story. I love this story. That a bunch of male anthropologists, you know, 100 and some years ago, a bunch of male anthropologists went to indigenous peoples and they would ask, so how do you not have babies? And of course they asked the men, because the men are the only ones worth talking to, and the men would go, that's a very involved question. You involve singing and blah, blah, blah. And so the anthropologists would go back and they would write that indigenous peoples don't know where babies come from. And then women anthropologists started to go out in the field and they started asking the women, how do you not have babies? And the women are like, okay, when you're 16, you eat a certain root and then it makes you sterile for 5 years. And then when you're 21, you do this and blah, blah, blah. And the men are like, really? I had no idea. Okay, so the 9th premise is, although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of these ways would be characterized by extreme violence. Nuclear Armageddon, for example, would reduce the population, yet would do so horrifically. The same would be true for a continuation of overshoot followed by crash. Other ways would be characterized by less violence or no violence. I don't know how the future is going to play out, but this much I know. If we don't approach this actively, we don't talk about our predicament and what we're going to do about it, the violence that comes will almost undoubtedly be far more severe and the privation more extreme. And I want to be really clear again that every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. I mean, if I ran for president, I would run on a platform of vasectomies for every male. And I even had a campaign slogan. Ready? It would be a snip in every sack. I'm ready to run. But I don't... Thank you. That makes two votes. But I don't think it's going to happen, you know? Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about, actually, is that I was doing a talk in Eugene, Oregon, and I was doing two talks the same day, actually, and this one woman hated what I had to say so much that she came to both talks. And she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And the reason is because they committed mass murder, and because I want to deindustrialize, and deindustrializing will kill a lot of people. And she raises, I don't like the comparison, but she raises a very good point, which is, basically, what are we going to do about the fact that no matter what we do at this point, we're committing mass murder? If you participate in this economy, your hands are blood red. And if you don't stop this economy, your hands are blood red. And if you do stop it, your hands are blood red. What do you do? And I have a bunch of answers that I didn't come up with that day. The first one is that when I talk about bringing down civilization, I want to give you a definition, by the way, of what I mean by bringing down civilization. My definition is that to bring down civilization means to deprive the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and to deprive the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. Thanks. That's nice, Derek, but as civilization crashes, a lot of people are going to die. Okay, my next answer is that when I talk about bringing down civilization, that's not a monolithic act. It's a bazillion different acts done by a bazillion different people, including non-human people, all over. And they all have different moralities. For example, I don't care what your motivation is, you cannot make a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. I don't care if you are a member of the U.S. military, I don't care if you're an anarcho-primitivist, you cannot make a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. Oh yeah, actually you can if you're bringing freedom and democracy to the country. Which, by the way, I figured out how you listen to George Bush's speeches. It's great. Well, first turn off this volume. But another way to do it is, do you remember the whole thing about freedom fries when they weren't going to call them french fries anymore? That gave me the answer, which is what you do is a word substitution. Every time he mentions the word freedom, substitute the word fascism. Every time he says the word democracy, substitute corporate control. Perfect. We are bringing democracy and freedom. Or we're bringing freedom and democracy to Iraq. Damn straight. Right there. Oh, and except there's one word, which is we. I gotta think about this too. Because I think it's really important not to identify with those in power. It's like this friend of mine called me up a while ago and she said, how much longer do you think we're gonna be in Iraq? And I said, we're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California. And she's like, okay, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? I said, I got troops? Holy shit, will they do what I tell them? If I tell them to take out the Grand Coulee, will they do it? And she's like, you know, Derek, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. So anyway, I don't think you can make, I mean, you cannot, you, it's not I don't think, you cannot make a moral case for taking out a children's hospital. You can't do it. On the other hand, I think it would be almost impossible to make a moral case against taking out a cell phone tower. And, you know, cell phone towers are really nasty. I mean, first off, they allow that jerk at the next table to yammer on when you're trying to eat. Second, they have, you know, the whole thing with the electromagnetic waves, and then they bounce into your head, and then you gotta wear the aluminum beanie, and if you put the beanie on the wrong way inside, then the thoughts just keep bouncing. Does that happen to you too? And then also, cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds every year. And then I don't know if you know the latest theory on why the bees are disappearing. It's cell phones, actually. They've known for a long time that cell phones mess up their navigational, I don't want to say navigational systems, because that's mechanistic language, but their ability to navigate. So it would be almost, okay, I can make a case. Here we go. I'll make a moral case against taking out a cell phone tower. This woman's driving along late at night, and she's all by herself, and she's out on a lonely road, and her car dies. Oh my God, you know what I just said? Her car dies. The car's not alive. It's like, then when I get outside, the cars are going, yeah, we're going to show you, buddy. Their car conks out. And she, you know, sort of drifts over the side of the road. And so she has a cell phone, and, she dials 911. And, the sheriff answers, and a different one. And, he says he'll be right out to, start her car for her. And, so then she's sitting there, and she's waiting, and she turns on the radio. And as she's waiting, it's a lonely night. She's waiting. She hears that a homicidal maniac broke out of the homicidal maniac place. I think they call it the White House. He's got a hook on his arm. So the sheriff shows up, and he starts her car for her. And then she drives away, and she feels this tug right as the car starts. And she gets home, and then she looks in the passenger side door, and there's this bloody hook embedded in the door. Your siblings didn't torment you with this story when you were a child? Okay, so a cell phone saved her life. You know, that's a moral case for keeping up a cell phone tower. But on the other hand, I can just as easily make a case for, you know, moral case for taking him out. Because, okay, this woman's driving along late at night, and she decides to call her mother. And she never calls her mother. And her mother rushes to the phone, she picks it up, and she trips and breaks her neck right when she's, you know, she falls because she's hurrying to the phone. And she gasps into the phone, call 911. And then she also says, why don't you ever call me? And then her daughter then calls 911, thank God she's got two cell phones. And but she's driving without using the steering wheel, and so she veers off the road. She runs over three orphans, and then she runs over the last population of endangered salamander, and then smashes into this tree. And the last thing she sees before she passes out is a hook gleaming in the moonlight. So the point, the point, insofar as there is one, is that we can make up hypothetical cases. We don't know how the future is going to be. We can make up hypothetical cases. It'll keep us from doing anything. You know, I can't do this because then this will happen and then this will happen. You know, we can make up whatever we want. Okay, that's my second answer, but that's fine, Derek. But a lot of people are going to die. Okay, here's my third answer. Which people are we talking about? Are we talking about salmon people? Are we talking about swordfish people? Are we talking about polar bear people? I mean, if you ask the salmon, should we bring down civilization now? The salmon are like, yes. You know, you ask polar bears, they're like, yep. You ask prairie dogs, and they're like, yep, yep, yep. Okay, what about, but we don't actually, forget non-humans, you know, they're not important anyway. What about humans? Okay, do you think subsistence farmers would be better off immediately? It's like I asked Anuradha Mittal, who's former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she started laughing and said, of course. And one of the examples she gave is there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And so there are people starving to death in India. I mean, everybody knows this, right? That most countries where famine occurs are actually net food exporters. The famous Irish potato famine, they were exporting grain. And so subsistence farmers would be better off immediately. Extant indigenous peoples living on their land would be better off immediately. The rural poor in general would be better off immediately. The rural rich have guns. They'd be fine. The urban poor, of course, would be really, really fucked. And they're already fucked. And that's one of the brilliant things about this whole system is that just like any good abusive system, it has made us dependent upon the very system that's exploiting us. And that's one of the reasons that more of us actually don't defend the land where we live. Is if your experience, not your head, not your heart, but if your experience is that your food comes from a grocery store and your water comes from a tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it. If, on the other hand, your food comes from the land and your water comes from a river, people used to drink from rivers, how quaint is that? Then you will defend to the death that land base because your life depends on it. That's one of the problems is that we've been, once again, made dependent upon this very system. We're painted into a corner. That's nice, Derek, but it's still not an answer. Okay, I got another answer. I got two more answers. One answer is, I can guarantee that as this civilization crashes, that essentially 100% of the misery to humans is going to be caused by those whose lifestyles are already killing the planet, attempting to maintain that lifestyle to the very end. And we all know that right now there's enough food to feed everybody, blah, blah, blah. We all know that stuff. Another example of this is that we always hear the world's running out of water. World's running out of water. People are dying of thirst because the world's running out of water. Bullshit. Fucking bullshit. Goddamn fucking bullshit. George Bush, goddamn fucking bullshit. You know, 90% of the water used by industrial humans is used for agriculture and industry. So, golf course, yeah, don't even get me started on Las Vegas. Don't even get me started on golf courses either. People who live in cities use the same amount of water personally as are used for municipal golf courses. I mean, the next time somebody tells you to take a shorter shower, it's like, fuck off. You know, get rid of golf courses and we'll talk about it. It's like if the dams on the Colorado River were to fail, and of course every dam's eventually gonna fail, if the dams were to fail and the Colorado River once again to reach the ocean, how weird would that be? If the capitalist press is still around, I know they're going to bray as one that, oh, the people of Arizona and California and Nevada are going to die of thirst. But it's like, I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there existed a single golf course, so long as there existed a single lawn, so long as there existed a single swimming pool, so long as there existed a single irrigated alfalfa field in Arizona, so long as there existed a single citrus orchard, so long as Las Vegas still existed. It's like, I don't even want to hear a word of complaint until we talk about, until those are all gotten rid of. Or another way to put all this, thanks. Another way to put all this is that Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, said that they need to raise the Shasta Dam because, and this is a direct quote, it is Californians' God-given right to water their lawns. You cannot argue with that logic. Except, of course, with explosives. Okay, those are all great answers, Derek, but the truth is, a lot of people are still going to die. And I finally have an answer that I'm really happy with, which is, what do you do with the fact that no matter what you do, we're involved in mass murder? For now, I've got an answer. If you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. So who is going to win the Stanley Cup? We probably also agree that this crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with all this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and your conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who'll be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate, or if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams. By the way, I don't know how many dams there are in Canada. There are 2 million dams in the United States. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. If we only took out one of those 70,000 dams every day, it would take us 200 years to take them all out. Salmon don't have that long. Sturgeon don't have that long. People say all the time, God, Derek, you're so non-compromising, you're so militant, you're so radical. It's like, no, I'll compromise. 4 dams a day, it'll take us 50 years. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We need lawyers to file lawsuits. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting neighborhood gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. people taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants in preparation for the end of civilization do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. I have a new catchphrase, which is, dismantle globally, renew locally. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what will work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It's contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. Okay, 10th premise. And what we're going to do is we're going to do one, two, we'll do like four or five more premises, and then I'll read a couple, and then I'll bash hope, and then we'll do a couple, I'll read some very short things. Okay, just so we know where we're at. Okay, 10th premise. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. Do I need to talk about that one?
No.
Okay. I don't know if this ever happens to you. Sometimes I'll just be sitting here and suddenly a vision of Angelina Jolie will appear before me. She'll stand suspended in space. It makes me happy. It didn't used to. It used to worry me. But that was before she met Brad. I think Brad's really good for her. I didn't like Billy Bob.
Kenneth.
Who?
Kenneth.
Kenneth,
that's enough.
I don't think it is. Because we have not even gotten to Angelina Jolie's genitals yet. But other people might. And I care. And that's what's important. Speaking of genitals, though, did you know where she had Billy Bob's name tattooed? Oh, my God, I'll bet she was wishing his name was Ed. And then also, speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the San Francisco Chronicle, which means it must be true. What's the indigenous name for this place right here? What's the indigenous name for this place right here? That's the name of the people?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's insane that I know what used to be on Angelina... She took it off, by the way, that tattoo. I think it's insane that I know what used to be on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not probably on Nicole Kidman's genitals. Things which will never affect my own personal life, I guarantee. But that it took me about 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of several hundred Talawa about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket, and another massacre over here at a place called Achalet, another massacre at a place over here called Hawanket. I think it's crazy that, well, I think it's crazy that we drink bottled water, for one thing. This is how I know we're not going to have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. I think it's insane that I know that Pedro Martinez is not going to pitch until after the All-Star break, and that Mike Piazza is having a good year at DH so far, but that I can't name 10 species of edible plants and fungi who live within 100 yards of my home. Part of the reason that we don't defend the places we live is because we don't live there. We live with Brad and Angelina and Pedro and Mike and et cetera, et cetera. And Anna Nicole, you know, who the father was? I mean, God, I didn't like that guy. I wish it would have been somebody else. But anyway, back to this. I can't identify 10 species of edible plants and fungi. Let's try this. Within 100 yards of my home. Blackberry? Two blackberries. Himalayan blackberry and native blackberry. That counts as two, which is very important because I'm going to run out pretty quickly. Salmonberry, thimbleberry, salal, huckleberry, blackberry. chanterelles. Oops, chanterelles. And then and those big red mushrooms with white dots. You know, I was thinking, if I ate one of those, I could take out a dam all by myself. If I ate one of those, I could take out a dam with one finger. So, 10th premise. The culture as a whole, most of its members are insane. The culture is driven by a death urge, an urge to destroy life. Oh, another thing about this insanity, I think about this a lot. Like right now, you know, how many machines are within 10 yards of us? And how many wild animals are within 100 yards of us? How many machines do you have a daily relationship with versus how many wild animals do you have a daily relationship with? What? Wild humans count. Which means not many. Okay, 11th premise. From the beginning, this culture has been a culture of occupation, and the government's been a government of occupation. The culture is a culture of occupation, and the government is a government of occupation. All my American Indian friends, of course, tell me, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? I want to read something about the culture of occupation stuff. So, if Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? We'd watch television, by gum. What would we do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we do if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Here's my secret fantasy, which won't be secret now, which is that next time they have one of those WTO meetings, that all the cops turn around and they start shooting at the WTO representatives. Because they have a lot more in common with us than they do with the people they're protecting. And of course that can't happen because the violence can only flow down. I've been thinking about this too. What would happen if cops, instead of enforcing the so-called rights of corporations to make money, what would happen if they enforced cancer-free zones? And what would happen if they enforced Walmart-free zones? Or what would happen if they enforced clear-cut-free zones? Or what would happen if the cops actually forced timber companies to even obey the laws that are already on the books? And of course, that's never going to happen. You know, we may as well be talking about Angelina Jolie or something. This is fantasy land. But I was thinking about this. What if instead we start thinking, okay, you know, the cops aren't going to do it? What if we start having community enforcement? And what if we meant it? Just a thought. So what if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because I can't finish that sentence, because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and intoxify the landscape and water supplies? If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forest, and from there to the boardrooms and the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them the marching orders? And what would we do if space aliens came down from, that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space, and they were vacuuming the oceans, and they were deforesting the planet, and they were putting docks in every mother's breast milk, and they were changing the climate of the planet? What would we do if space aliens were doing that? I mean, I know exactly what we'd do. We would put on our camo outfits, we would grab our AK-47s, we would... Wrong audience. am I the only person here with an AK-47? A couple years ago, I shared the stage with Ward Churchill, and he was in the audience during my part of the talk, and I asked that question, am I the only person here with an AK-47? And the whole place is just silent. And then I hear this voice go, nope. I mean, what would we do if the Iraqis had invaded the United States? Well, you'd probably fucking applaud here, but you know, what would we do in the United States, what would you, you know, the Iraqis were so close to invading the United States. They were this close. But because these corporations and because these governments, you know, because we pledged allegiance to these governments when we were children, you know, it's a hard time. We have a hard time separating and start to seeing, you know, that they are the enemy. Derek, you're so dualistic. We'll talk about dualism in a minute. Okay, so maybe your sense of kin, your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. I mean, that's the thing, really. If you're not going to fight for a living planet, what are you going to fight for? Anyway, so maybe your sense of kin, your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'd fight for it. And by fight, I don't just mean picking up guns. That's a possibility, but I also mean fighting, any way, resisting, whatever your gifts are. What are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? I mean, do you know how to, I mean, I write, that's what I do. You know, somebody else, if they know how to hack, there you go. You know, if you know explosives, there you go. If you love law, there you go. You know, if you want to work at a battered women's shelter. It's like I was giving a talk in Olympia, Washington a few years ago, and we're all excited, yeah, let's bring down civilization. And I stopped and I said, okay, I'm just wondering, how many people here have ever filed a timber sale appeal? Two of us raised our hands. So how many people have ever worked at a battered women's shelter? Maybe a half dozen women raised their hands. How many people have ever done indigenous solidarity work? Maybe a half dozen people. How many people have ever worked on a rape crisis hotline? I mean, there is so much work to be done, and that includes above ground work, you know? That includes really boring, horrible stuff like pouring through county zoning regulations to seeing how you can stop a developer. You know, there's so much stuff, both above ground and below ground, that needs to be done. Anyway, maybe you don't love the land enough where you live enough that you'd fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? Would you fight back? How many people in here have had someone you love die of cancer? Good God. Usually it's about 80%. This is about 90% tonight. Cancer, of course, is a disease of civilization caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. Oh, no, sorry, it's caused by a cancer gene. Could have nothing to do with the fact that every stream in the United States is contaminated. This is USGS saying this, that every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you choose others its virtues, or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me a threshold, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give the threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. Twelfth premise. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. There's just people. The rich have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor don't. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are often denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of paper. Those without the papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world. Weyerhaeuser doesn't own any land. Weyerhaeuser doesn't really exist, but let's pretend it exists for a minute. It doesn't own any land. We all agree that Weyerhaeuser owns a bunch of land. There's a bunch of cars out there. They don't belong to anybody. They're wild and free. And we all agree that this car belongs to this person, that car belongs to that person. I can say that because my truck is about 1,000 miles away. Land ownership is a cultural convention. There is no such thing as land ownership in the way that we normally talk about. We all just agree that this land is owned by, you know, whomever, and that land's owned by whomever. And I want to be really careful when I say that I'm not saying, there's two things I'm not saying. One is I'm not saying that all cultural conventions are bad. What I'm saying is, with all the world at stake, we might start thinking about what cultural conventions we want to keep and what we want to get rid of. And I want to get rid of the notion of, well, first I want to get rid of the notion of corporations existing. Another is, I want to get rid of the notion of corporations owning land. I want to get rid of the notion of absentee land ownership. We can think of lots of others too. But the other part I want to say is, I'm not saying that there is no such thing as land ownership, because there is. The Talawa own the land where I live. Actually, my mom holds a piece of paper that says that she owns it, but the Talawa actually own it. And the reason they own it is because they lived there for 12,500 years, and their blood is mixed with the soil. And that's how you get to own land, is by living there and entering into that predator-prey relationship for generation after generation, and having your blood mixed with the soil and the soil mixed with your blood. And so there is that form of land ownership. That's different. Okay, 13th premise. Those in power rule by force, and the sooner we break ourselves of illusions to the contrary, the sooner we can at least begin to make reasonable decisions about whether, when, and how we're going to resist. We're going to skip the 14th premise and go to the 15th. Okay, this is the last premise I'm going to talk about. What we're going to do, talk about this premise, and then I'm going to bash hope, and then I'm going to read two short things. Okay, 15th premise is, love does not imply pacifism. And part of the reason I wrote this book is because Endgame, which I don't have them here, but they're big. There's two volumes, huge book. Is because when I would do talks about the question of fighting back, the audience response was really predictable, and that is that mainstream environmental activists and sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield. And that's, they would start to say the words Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, Gandhi, again and again, as quickly as they can. To keep all evil thoughts at bay. And then grassroots environmentalists would do the same thing, and then they would come up to me after the talk and say, thank you for bringing this up. And then other audiences had entirely different responses, which is a lot of people of color, especially poor people of color, a lot of American Indians, a lot of family farmers, a lot of survivors of domestic violence, a lot of radical environmentalists, of prisoners, would have an entirely different response, which is they would look at me like, tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro. And I realized that difference came because for those latter groups, violence is not some spiritual abstract question to be puzzled through. It's simply a part of life, and you deal with it. And that doesn't mean you participate, and it doesn't mean you don't participate. It means that it's not capital V violence. It's not reified into this big thing. It's part of life. And then I realized, or what started happening, is that whenever I would do these talks, the responses by the dogmatic pacifists were really, once again, predictable. And they would throw out all the same cliches. And what I wanted to do was write a short little pamphlet that I got so sick of answering them that I would just write this pamphlet and hand it to them. And then that turned into an 1,100-page book. And you see why tonight. So I want to go through a couple of the premises. Like one of them, they say, God, Derek, you're so divisive. You're so dualistic. You talk about us and them. You talk about an enemy. But there is no enemy. And you're talking about winning and losing. You talk about winning. Well, by the way, yes, I want to win. We are going to win. And what winning means to me is living on a livable planet. And what living means to me, once again, is living in a world with more wild salmon every year than the year before. I want to win. I'm going to win. I am not going to fucking lose this. Okay, anyway, so, what?
Thank you.
Oh, thanks. So people will say, you know, you're so divisive. There is no us and them. And you're being dualistic, and dualism is bad. And I would say, ah, so what you're telling me is dualism bad, non-dualism good. Checkmate. I thought that was somehow symbolic. And another thing they would say is, you know, Derek, obviously what we really need to do is we really need to love more. And if we just love the CEOs, then they will, you've gotten this one too, they will just Well, I don't know what the fuck they'll do, but they'll do something. And so you just need to love more, because if you really loved, Derek, if you deeply loved, you could never even consider fighting back. I disagree that love implies pacifism, and I think that Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on this one. I grew up in the country, and in my life, I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, dogs, cats, chickens, geese, hawks, eagles, hummingbirds, spiders, mice, who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse will attack someone 6,000 times her size and win, what the hell's wrong with us? I realize that actually they're right when they say that if I just loved enough, that what I need to do is love. They're wrong when they say that if you really love yourself, if you really love enough, then you'll never fight back. They're wrong when they say that. But they're right when they say that what we need is more love. And we do. We need to love ourselves. We need to love ourselves enough that we don't put up with this shit. We need to love ourselves enough that we say no more. We need to love ourselves enough to say, you are not going to do this to me or to those I love. And we need to love the land where we live enough that we will, I love the land where I live so much. It's at 17 feet elevation. And for the last couple of years, we in the neighborhood have been fighting this one developer who's trying to destroy this little forest that's right next door. And I was talking to my mom the other day about this, about global warming. And my mom said, and she probably won't live to see this, but my mom said that if the sea rises in her lifetime, she'll kill herself because she doesn't want to see this land she loves go under. And I said, so are you going to take anybody else out first? So another one that they throw out all the time is you can't use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. They said all the time. And I can guarantee a couple things. One is that the people who say that have never read the essay from which it comes, because it has nothing to do with pacifism. What it has to do with is we need a multivariate approach to a problem that's multivariate. That's all Audre Lorde's saying. And that's what we're talking about here. And the other thing I can guarantee is that Audre Lorde never worked construction, because it's a terrible metaphor. It doesn't matter whose tools you use. I can use my tools, I can use your tools, I can use the master's tools, I can use my cousin's tools. A hammer is a hammer. And it's really stupid. Are we going to say to Tecumseh, sorry, you can't use the guns that you picked up from the white people to keep them from taking your land? It's like, no, that's really silly. I have no interest. My job as an activist is not to be spiritually pure. I have no interest. I have zero interest in spiritual purity. What I have interest in is confronting and dismantling power. And I don't fucking care how I do it. So it's like, another problem with that metaphor, the way it's used, is that presumes that violence is one of the master's tools. But those in power are trying to tell us they own the land, they're trying to tell us they own the water, they're trying to tell us they own genetic materials, they're trying to tell us they own the air. I'll be goddamned if I give them violence too. They don't own it. And I think, once again, Mother Grizzly Bears are going to back me up on this one. What's another one they throw out? Anybody in here have my book, A Language Older Than Words? Okay, those of you who have that book, do you also have a razor blade? Okay, if you do, take the chapter called Violence Revisited, cut out the pages, crumple them up, throw them away. Because I say something in that chapter that is so embarrassing. I can't even. I'm embarrassed. I can't even hardly say. It's like admitting to being a compulsive masturbator, which I'm not. Okay. So I missed it.
Who cares?
Well, okay, we can talk about that then. Okay, so anyway, what I say in that chapter is that if you fight back, I'd rather talk about masturbation, frankly. If you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. That is one of the stupidest things I've ever heard in my life. Does this mean that when Tecumseh fought back, he ran the risk of becoming like the people who are stealing their land? Does this mean that the woman who kills a rapist runs a risk of becoming a rapist? Does this mean that the tiger who kills a zookeeper runs a risk of becoming a zookeeper? It's utterly nonsensical. Let's do one more cliche that they throw out. Oh, this is the worst one. This is also a really bad one. They always say violence never accomplishes anything. That is obscene. Okay, if violence doesn't accomplish anything, that means that all the Africans who came over on the Middle Passage, they just signed up. You know, it's like they jumped on the boats and said, here, let's go over and then let's work in the fields. What this means is that when the whites arrived on this continent, that the Indians said, hey, you want some land? Here you go. You can have it. There's a great line by Robin Morgan. She says, anywhere in the world, any woman can be walking alone late at night. And if she hears footsteps behind her, she has reason to be afraid. She calls that the democracy of fear. Systematic terrorization of women by men has changed the behavior of half of the human population. Don't tell me that violence doesn't accomplish anything. Violence is dreadfully effective. That's why they use it. So, a few years ago, a friend of mine called me up late at night, and she said, she's an environmental activist, works on toxics issues, and she called me up and she said, I can't take it anymore. This work's just killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, it'll do that. She said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. Then she said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say is because about 12 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just bursting into tears several times a week over the death of the salmon, kootenai, sturgeon, Selkirk caribou, bull trout. And a lot of my environmentalist friends said, Derek, just take some time off. The problem will still be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? What if you're not going to cry about global warming, what do tears mean? And I knew I had to just keep pushing through. And one day, I called up this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. I was crying, and I said to her, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. She said, yeah, it'll do that. I said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. I said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that sorrow is just sorrow and pain's just pain. And it's not so much my sorrow or even pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. It let me know that I could feel all of those things and it wouldn't kill me. And there's this idea that if you really acknowledge how bad things are, you have to go around being miserable all the time. But the truth is, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really, really fucked. And that life is really, really good. And that we are so fucked. And that life is so good. you know, some people have said to me, so if things are so bad, why don't you just kill yourself? And I always respond, because I'm having a good time. There's this great Irish proverb, is this a private fight or can anybody join? And I love that. And another one I get is, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? And the answer is, I don't really like parties. And I realize that that question, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? I realize that question reveals nothing more nor less than an incapacity to love. Because if you're in love, you act to defend your beloved. That's what you do. Oh, yeah. This person wrote to me a couple years ago, and she wanted to know how my anger at the dominant culture affects my sex life. And I was so tempted to write back, that is a question to which you will never know the answer. I realized that her question is based on the idea that anger is a shotgun, that if you're angry, you're angry. But the truth is, I'm really angry at the things that make me angry, and I'm not angry at the things that don't make me angry. My anger at Weyerhaeuser or at Charles Hurwitz doesn't spill over onto my friends. So we can feel all those things. And there's an even better thing about feeling all those things and realizing that it won't kill you, which is you can feel all those things and you realize it does kill you. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. Not with threats, not with promises, not with anything. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get on a cattle car? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower? Or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Zygmunt Bauman, in an extraordinary book, Modernity and the Holocaust, says that rational people will go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And likewise, rational people go quietly, meekly to the end of the world if only you allow them to believe that compact fluorescents are going to save the day. So I'll tell you something very important about, you know, that every step of the way being in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. I'll tell you something very important, which is the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No. Listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father is because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason that she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations and they blind us to real possibilities. And we need to work desperately to eradicate false hope. What are the false hopes that keep us going? I mean, does anybody really think that Weyerhaeuser will stop deforesting because we ask nicely? Does anybody really think that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing because we ask nicely? Does anybody think that if we just get a Democrat in the White House, things are going to be okay? Things are not okay, and they're not going to be okay. But the problem isn't just false hope. It's hope itself. I was doing a talk a couple years ago in Colorado, and someone in the audience shouted out, as I'm bashing hope, someone in the audience shouted out, what's your definition of hope? It's like, God, I got no idea. You know, I've been bashing hope for years. I have no idea what I'm talking about. And I asked them to come up with a definition. And the definition they came up with is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. That's how we use it in everyday language. You know, I know that men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but I'm going to commit to you right now in public that I am going to eat something tomorrow. I don't say I hope I'm going to eat something. I'm just going to do it. In fact, I don't even need to commit to it. By gum, I'm going to do it. On the other hand, the next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash. Because once I'm in the air, I have no agency. So, I want to be really clear. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. Anyway, I'll back up a second. I don't hope that coho salmon survive. If they don't like how they're being treated, and so they wish to go away, I will say goodbye, and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, I won't allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I will do whatever it takes to make sure they survive. And it's really simple. It's really simple. This isn't usually part of my talk, but I want to say this, that what do salmon need to survive? It's very, very straightforward. They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for the oceans not to be murdered. And they need for global warming to stop, which means they need the industrial economy to stop. Those are all very straightforward technical tasks. That doesn't mean they're not fraught with a few challenges. But they're straightforward tasks. When people say, how can we help the salmon to survive? What they're really saying is, how can we help the salmon to survive without taking out dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, et cetera, et cetera? The answer is, you can't. Once again, I do not hope that coho salmon survive. I'll do whatever it takes to make sure they survive. And it is customary, when speaking of the apocalypse, to end on a happy note. So I'm going to read two things, and then we'll stop and do Q&A or whatever. And these two things are about as happy as you're going to get from me. One of them is the most beautiful thing I've ever written, and I didn't actually write it. It was written, the author is a stream right near my home. I was trying to write about what it's like to be a river, and I tried for several days and I couldn't get anywhere. And then I realized that that's really pretty stupid for me to do that when there's a stream right near my home. That would be like me writing about what it's like to be a woman, what I can just ask you. So I went down to the river, or to the stream, and I said, what is it like to be you? And I realized in that moment that that's the fundamental question in any relationship. It's a question we don't ask often enough of our lovers, of our neighbor trees, who might also be our lovers, of the land where we live. It's not a question we ask of our friends, of our siblings, of our parents, of our children. What is it like to be you? So I asked this stream, what is it like to be you? And the stream had been waiting so long for someone to ask. It gave me the answer in like literally 5 seconds. And then I ran inside to write it down as quickly as I could. And as I'm running inside, I hear the forest going, hello, what about me? What's it like to be me? Anyway. Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pocks and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more in pools and rivers and move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You are the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You are the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You are the pressure who pushes water through seams. You are the brushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving. You are the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You are the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You are the mist who settles on the soil. You are the plants who drink the mist, and you're the sun who warms and feeds them. You're the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river whose all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees, and the meadows you flood and feed, and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forest. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You are the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who become owls, who become slugs, who become shrews, who become soil. You are the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You're the wind who speaks through the trees, and the trees who speak through the wind. You're the birds who sing, and the birds who do not. You are the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers, waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold. And you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die. The last thing I want to talk about is the tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers. It's called the picket, pin, and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers would be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground, even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe, or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point, at which you'll finally stop running, at which you'll finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, and we would be two. Two more might join, and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight, and we will be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people, and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps the most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, so Derek, what do you want us to do with all this analysis? What do you want us to do with all this information? And I always say, I want you not to listen to me. I don't know how to live sustainably, and I don't live here. I don't know how to live sustainably here. If you want to know what to do, ask the Fraser River. It will tell you. If you ask it and ask it and ask it, it will tell you how to live here sustainably, and it will tell you what it needs. And then really the only question is, are you willing to do it? So thank you very much.